that's why they call love a drug.
Michael Zizek.
I'm Scott.
You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will start with the ICC ruling of last week. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, has issued arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, who Netanyahu fired right after Trump was elected, Yoav Gallant. The court also issued an arrest warrant for a Hamas commander, Mohammed Daif, but he is believed to have been killed in July by the Israeli military. The process for these arrest warrants by the ICC started back in May and initially included two other Hamas leaders as well, Ismail Haniyeh and Yahya Sinwar, but both have been killed since as well. In the first part of the show, we will cover this news and see the significance of these warrants and what was Canadian politicians' reaction to it. Will Canada respect these arrest warrants, being a founding member of the ICC? According to The Guardian, France initially said that it would fulfill its obligations and respect these arrest warrants as France is a signatory to the Rome Statute, which is the ICC's founding document. But on Wednesday, the French Foreign Ministry appeared to change its tone and claim that Netanyahu is actually immune from these arrest warrants because Israel was not a signatory to the statute. Now, of course, not surprising, France didn't have that perspective when the ICC released arrest warrants against Russian President Vladimir Putin, despite Russia not being a signatory either. So this flip-flop by France is believed to have been a concession by the French government to the Israeli government in return of a ceasefire in Lebanon. We will cover this ceasefire reached between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon in the second part of the show and see how reliable that ceasefire is and how Lebanese and Israeli citizens are reacting to this news. Finally, at the end of the show, we will come back to Montreal and hear a report on the anti-NATO protest that took place last week. The main grievances by the protesters this time is NATO's support for the Israeli government, despite the war crimes it has been committing for a year against Palestinians. The police has been accused to use excessive force against the protesters. So we will hear what some of these protesters witnessed and endured during the protest. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Tom McRae. The International Criminal Court has issued warrants for the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Defence Minister he sacked, Yoav Gallant, saying there are reasonable grounds to believe they have committed war crimes in Gaza. It's also issued a warrant for senior Hamas figure Mohammed Deif. Less than a day earlier, the US vetoed a motion at the UN Security Council calling for a ceasefire, standing alone in its opposition to the proposal. As the chatter and briefing continued after the vote in New York, dozens more Palestinians were being killed by Israel in Gaza. During 13 months of war and with nearly 44,000 dead, the US has not backed a single motion at the UN calling for a ceasefire, abstaining only once to allow a motion to pass in March. Israel ignored that, continuing its genocidal war with US weapons and Western support. So will the arrest warrants have any impact on US policy? Is the US becoming more isolated over its support for Israel? And what would it take to get the US to support a ceasefire and break with Israel over Gaza? We'll be speaking with our guests shortly, but first this report from Umi Kulsoom Sharif.
The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his former defense chief Yoav Gallant, and Hamas leader Mohammed Deif on charges of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. It comes a day after the United States once again backed Israel at the United Nations Security Council.
Those against?
Casting a lone no vote, the US vetoed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The proposal demanded an immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire. It also called for the release of captives held by Hamas. But despite weeks of backroom discussions to craft a motion that would pass, the Biden administration killed it.
We made clear throughout negotiations we could not support an unconditional ceasefire that failed to release the hostages. Because, as this council has previously called for, a durable end to the war must come with the release of the hostages. These two urgent goals are inextricably linked.
14 of the 15 council members voted in favor of the ceasefire plan. It's the fourth time the US has used its veto to block a ceasefire resolution since the war began more than a year ago. The Palestinian ambassador says the veto power is allowing Israel to continue its genocide in Gaza.
There is no right to mass killing of civilians. There is no right to starve an entire civilian population. There is no right to forcibly displace a people. And there is no right to annexation. This is what Israel is doing in Gaza. These are its war objectives. This is what the absence of a ceasefire is allowing it to continue doing.
Majid Bamia said the defeat of the motion will just mean more death and destruction.
A ceasefire doesn't resolve everything, but it is the first step towards resolving anything. And what is the answer of those who are still unwilling now, after all this death and destruction, not to call for an unconditional ceasefire? Is it to accept that the killing should continue until we resolve everything while we watch that we are resolving nothing?
Israel's ambassador thanked the US for its support and said the war in Gaza will continue.
The resolution brought before this chamber was not a path to peace. It was a roadmap to more terror, more suffering, and more bloodshed. Israel will continue to defend itself.
Wednesday's veto comes as Israel continues killing, displacing and starving Palestinians in Gaza. There have been repeated warnings of famine in the northern region where no aid has been delivered in 40 days. A recent UN report said Israel's campaign in the Strip is consistent with the characteristics of a genocide. Despite that, the UNSC is still unable to take action. Umi Kulsoom Sharif, Al Jazeera, for Inside Story.
Okay, let's get a range of perspectives on the US veto from our guests in London, Ontario, in Canada. Michael Link is a human rights lawyer and the former special rapporteur for human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. In Dubai, Halawari was an American diplomat for 18 years, focusing on political affairs, human rights and counterterrorism. That was until April when she became the first US career diplomat to publicly resign over President Biden's Gaza policies. And in Amman, Shana Lowe, who is a communication advisor in Palestine for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Thank you all very much for being here on what is turning out to be a historic day for Israel, as well as the Middle East in general and the wider world, of course. Michael, if I can first of all start with you, as a human rights lawyer, can you just put into context and give us the significance of these International Criminal Court arrest warrants that have been handed down?
Well, you're right. This is historic, and it's historic also for international law as well, and the whole concept of accountability. We've had lots and lots of international law that's pronounced very critically with respect to Israel's conduct of its occupation and with Israel's conduct of this war on Gaza. Yet this is the first time that an ally of the United States where arrest warrants have been issued by the International Criminal Court. This will mean that Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant will not be able to travel to 124 countries, including virtually all of Europe, because those countries are members of the Rome Assembly for the International Criminal Court, and they are obliged by the Rome Statute to arrest anybody for whom there are outstanding warrants for. This also obviously stains further Israel's reputation in the world with respect to its standing among other countries, its standing at the United Nations, and it also increases the stain with respect to the United States. The one thing I'm worried about in the months ahead is how the United States will wind up reacting. We've seen letters written to the court by Republican senators saying, we're warning you, do not take any steps against our ally Israel with respect to arrest warrants. So a showdown is coming in the months ahead.
Okay, we'll get on to the repercussions of that potential showdown a little later in the program. But Shana, I want to come to you next and just outline a little bit of the detail that the ICC put out there. They said that the crimes alleged against Netanyahu and Gallant include using starvation as a tool of war, and say that there are reasonable grounds to believe that two of them oversaw attacks on civilian populations. I mean, does this vindicate all of the voices around the world that have been saying that is exactly what has been happening in Gaza for over a year now?
Absolutely. For over a year, as you said, we've been calling out, we've been saying that Israel has been obstructing aid. Israel has made it very, very clear that they had intentions to obstruct aid from the very beginning of this escalation of hostilities. And we've seen consistently throughout the past year that time and again, humanitarian assistance is being prevented from entering Gaza, being prevented from being brought to communities in need. We're seeing an entire population on the brink of famine. People are starving. Just this week, the UN reported that in south of Wadi Gaza, where the conditions were a bit better than in the north, only 16% of families received their a reduced monthly food parcel. I mean, this is after a year of us calling for openings of more crossings, calling for an increase of aid, calling for protection of humanitarian workers and civilians so that aid could be safely distributed. It's no surprise that the court found this, because this is what we've been saying for more than a year.
Mm. Hala, obviously the US has been the biggest backer of Netanyahu and Israel and its war in Gaza. Can that US support continue, though, given these arrest warrants?
Unfortunately, it will. And let me just start by pausing and acknowledging what most of the world is feeling right now. Finally, there's a sense that the international community is taking action. Far a little too late, but this is not just strictly about Gaza. It really is about the rules-based order. It's about international humanitarian law. It's about justice. And the fact that finally, after over a year of genocide, the ICC has come to this decision, it's almost as if we, so many of us, have been holding our breath and we can finally breathe a sigh of relief. But I can assure you, and this is very unfortunate, but I can assure you that the United States and this administration will continue to do everything it can to undermine this decision. I can imagine right now what's happening in the State Department. Secretly, many American diplomats are celebrating this because they do believe in the rule of law. But the political decision coming from the White House and from the Biden-Harris administration is support Israel at all costs, even if it violates international law, even if it violates American law, even if it loses an election. And we're going to continue to see that, unfortunately, even after this ICC decision.
Okay, so in your eyes, you don't see anything changes when it comes to the support of Israel by the United States. Michael, we know Israel doesn't accept or recognize the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, but what does it actually mean going forward? Does anything change when it comes to Netanyahu? I mean, apart from, you know, potentially being restricted from traveling to 124 countries?
No. Keep in mind that the International Criminal Court does not hold trials in absentia. You actually have the defendants present in the courtroom in The Hague in order to proceed. So unless Israel voluntarily surrenders them, which it will never do, or the United States voluntarily surrenders them, which it will never do either, there will be no trials for the foreseeable future, because the two defendants will avoid those countries that belong to the Rome Statute and who are compelled to issue the arrest warrants. But as we said, this will further stain Israel's standing. It will further stain the United States' standing as well.
Just quickly, how difficult will it be to prove these cases in court, especially in the charge of weaponizing hunger in Gaza, which they've been accused of?
Well, you can be sure that the prosecutor's office would not have sought the arrest warrants, which it did in June, unless it had strong evidence with respect to these various crimes, including the crime of starvation and the blockage of humanitarian aid. But there has been an extraordinary amount of evidence, an extraordinary amount of statements made by respected and responsible organizations, including the United Nations, including many major humanitarian organizations that can testify to the ways in which the population is suffering with respect to the lack of food, the lack of water, the lack of housing, and the lack of other forms of humanitarian aid in Gaza. So all of that, I'm sure, has already been assembled and will continue to be assembled in the prosecutor's office should one or both defendants wind up in The Hague.
Okay. Shane, does this change anything for the people in Gaza right now? I mean, is it going to change the conditions there, or is there actually a fear that Israel could push back even harder against that and take it out on the people that are trying to survive in the Strip?
What we've seen over the last year is that very little influences Israel in its decision making and ability or willingness to permit more aid, improve the humanitarian situation. Just over a month ago, we saw the U.S. administration, the Secretaries Blinken and Austin, sent a letter to Israel giving Israel 30 days to improve humanitarian conditions on the ground in Gaza. We, along with seven other NGOs, submitted a report card that found that Israel overwhelmingly failed at meeting each metric that the U.S. had laid out for them to show improvement in. And October saw the lowest number of trucks, a daily average of only 37 trucks entering Gaza. Yet somehow the American administration found that Israel had met the conditions that they had set forth and decided to allow Israel to proceed without any type of consequence. So I think so long as Israel does not face actual consequences, so long as there's no accountability, we're only going to continue to see Israel acting with impunity, and civilians who have been bearing the brunt of this for the last almost 14 months are going to continue to suffer and be deprived of the basic needs that they have for their survival.
Mm. Hala, you were the first U.S. diplomat to publicly resign because of Biden's policies when it came to Gaza. You talked a little bit about some people in the diplomatic corps in the U.S. might be privately cheering the ICC's decision to charge the two of them. Do you think that more will follow your lead and step down or at least speak out loudly against Biden's policy?
To be quite frank, Tom, I don't think Moore will resign. And I'm not very thrilled to be saying that out loud. But what I saw when I was still in the department before my resignation was an absolute chilling effect that diplomats, experts were basically told to be quiet, to keep their expertise to themselves and to fall in line. And that's what I saw most diplomats doing, fall in line. But I would urge my former colleagues that this is the time to not fall in line. I swore an oath to the Constitution when I became an American diplomat. And it is because of that oath that I submitted my resignation. Now I can tell you what's going to happen after this. The State Department is going to write something called demarches, that every embassy and consulate is going to have to demarche the host government, meaning provide some talking points. And they're going to try to discredit this ICC ruling. They're going to do everything they can to get other countries to publicly discredit this ICC ruling. Now, for those conscientious diplomats, I urge my former colleagues, refuse to deliver those demarches. Push back on Washington. Even if you can't resign publicly, don't go along with the illegality of this policy any longer. As Shana outlined, the Palestinian people can't suffer any longer. And it's time for all of us to use our voice, including those that remain within the State Department.
Hala, just on the U.S. veto at the U.N. Security Council, I mean, the proposal basically said it demanded an immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire. It also called for the release of captives that have been held by Hamas. So what exactly did the US have a problem with? Can you just give us that context?
So I can give you the State Department's official talking point, right, which I absolutely do not agree with. What is coming out of the podium is they will not agree to a ceasefire unless the prerequisite is the release of the hostages. It is a very one-sided perspective. As was mentioned, the ceasefire resolution was clear, unconditional release of the hostages. And I can say that is absolutely disgusting. I'm not mincing my words. It's disgusting that the administration is using the hostages to continue this genocide. The families of the hostages, their pain and their suffering, in order to continue arming Israel, in order to continue violating human rights, international law, the families of the hostages themselves are protesting against Netanyahu every day. They recognize that he has been the obstacle. They recognize that Hamas has agreed to previous ceasefire deals and that Netanyahu has changed the goalposts every single time. That is why they have publicly been denouncing Prime Minister Netanyahu and have been protesting against him and his government on a regular basis. Yet the administration refuses to put blame where it belongs and is using the suffering of the hostages and is also enabling them to remain hostages. There is a diplomatic solution if the U.S. administration chooses to use its leverage, chooses to abide by U.S. law, which would mean to halt offensive military weapons to Israel. That would force a deal. Yet the U.S. administration currently refuses to do that. And people on all sides are suffering as a result.
A number of the U.S. allies also backed the resolution. After the vote, there was a discussion. And Majid Bamia, the State of Palestine's deputy U.N. envoy, very powerfully said at the Security Council session, a ceasefire doesn't resolve everything, but is the first step towards resolving anything. Take a listen to what he said.
Maybe for some we have the wrong nationality, the wrong faith, the wrong skin color. But we are humans. And we should be treated as such. Is there a UN charter for Israel that is different from the charter you all have? Tell us. Is there an international law for them, an international law for us? Do they have the right to kill? And the only right we have is to die.
Well, the statement has gone viral and has been picked up right around the world. Shana, do you think that that is because it's exactly how Palestinians feel right now?
Absolutely. Palestinians, especially those in Gaza, feel abandoned by the world. They feel that there's a double standard. They see one set of rhetoric for Russia's occupation of Ukraine and another rhetoric applied to them living under occupation for more than 55 years at this point. And so for Palestinians, they've lost, at least the ones that we speak to in Gaza and the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory, they've lost hope and confidence in the international system. They've lost confidence in international law. They don't understand how their suffering has been broadcast for more than 13 months on television, and yet people continue to die each day, not just those being killed by the bombs and bombardment, but those being killed due to deprivation of food, medicine, clean water, shelter. And so it's not surprising to hear Mr. Bamia speak at the UN about the feelings of the double standards that Palestinians are facing, and the fact that their suffering has gone unaddressed for over a year in Gaza and over 55 years of occupation and 75 years of displacement.
It's really important that everyone abide by international law.
Well, I gotta say, I'm a little bit surprised. Justin Trudeau has answered a question around the recent ruling from the International Criminal Court and their issuing of an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister. And I am pleasantly surprised by Trudeau's reaction to this. So here is Trudeau's response to that news.
Now that the ICC has issued warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, Canadian law enforcement is obligated to arrest them should they come to Canada. Will you allow that to happen, or will you step in to prevent an arrest?
First of all, as Canada has always said, it's really important that everyone abide by international law. This is something we've been calling on from the beginning of the conflict. We are one of the founding members of the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice. We stand up for international law, and we will abide by all the regulations and rulings of the international courts. This is just who we are as Canadians.
Now, I would have preferred him to say, let's jail him now. So it wasn't as clear or as vocal as that. But this is the right move. Hey, this is an internationally recognized body. They have come to this conclusion based on all of the evidence present, not to mention just the obvious. Of course, we've seen what's gone on over the past year. That, yes, we are going to abide by those rules. Meaning, if Netanyahu enters Canada, he's arrested. So this is very encouraging, especially if you compare this. The reaction from the Biden administration is disgusting. Essentially calling out the process, saying we have to look into this, we can't trust this. Essentially just disregarding the ruling. For the obvious reason being that Israel is a massive ally of the U.S. The U.S. has been funding the genocide, and they're totally cool with it, as Israel is a strategic ally for them in the Middle East. So they don't mind overlooking a little genocide to benefit themselves. But this was also put out. This is from the NDP MP, Heather McPherson here. She is the, just to get her proper title, the foreign affairs critic for the NDP. So saying here, Canada must support the arrest warrants for Netanyahu, Gallant, and Deif. Canada played a pivotal role in establishing the ICC. The government must confirm today that as a state party to the Rome Statute, it will execute these warrants. So good to see as well. Of course, it's expected that the NDP would be in agreement with this as well. Compare that with good old Pierre Poilievre. So here is Michael Chong, who is their foreign affairs critic, or their, sorry, shadow foreign affairs minister. Writing here, and you can see Pierre Poilievre reposted it. The ICC arrest warrants for the former defense minister and the prime minister of Israel are outrageous. Oh, how dare they go after these people committing genocide. The ICC is drawing a false equivalency between a liberal democracy and a terrorist group that attacked the democracy last year. Yeah, how about the ongoing genocide? How about the fact that they are occupying territory? Let's just ignore all of that. Let's ignore the entire occupation. And oh, look, false equivalency. Yeah, you know what? I agree. There is a false equivalency. One side is committing a massive genocide where an estimated 100,000 people have been killed. Civilians. So that's what the conservative government brings. This trash. And it's right in line with what Pierre Poilievre has been doing. This is from October 8th. Canadian Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre supports Israel's right to strike Iranian sites. Pierre Poilievre supporting a world war. Fantastic. Lovely. Would be great to see. Let's encourage a world war. Insanity. Here's Pierre Poilievre shortly after. This is December 4th, 2023. As Israel was committing war crimes in Gaza, here is Pierre Poilievre posing with the Israeli flag. And there's a larger piece on this. I'll link to this below the video separately. But Pierre Poilievre's incoming war support, war on support for Palestine. Quote, a Poilievre-led government would be a largely a reintroduction of the foreign policy of Stephen Harper. And it goes deep into just essentially, it's exactly what you would expect from the stuff I just showed you. There is no discussions about, you know, human rights from the Conservative Party. They don't care at all about any kind of international order. It's simply about strategic allies and who they think benefits them personally. And it's gross. Contrast that with Jungmeet Singh. This is from February 14th. So this is earlier on in the ongoing mass atrocities. And here's what he said at the time.
And potential ground incursion will be a slaughter. Thousands of innocent Palestinians will die. The liberals act as if they're concerned, but they authorize $28.5 million in new military exports to Netanyahu. The prime minister has the power and the responsibility to protect civilians. When will the prime minister stop selling arms to Netanyahu?
You're here.
So Jagmeet Singh has been very, very consistent on this throughout the conflict, as well as this was out recently, just yesterday. Canadian MPs joined international push for recognition of Palestinian state, including NDP Green Leaders Bloc MP, also part of a letter writing campaign. So 30 Canadian MPs, which also, by the way, includes four members of the Liberal Caucus. There are members of the Liberal Party which are more consistent on the human rights of Palestinians than the rest of the party is. That said, of course, not a single conservative here. Of course. So, you know, it's encouraging to see how the Liberal Party has, I guess you could say, evolved, for lack of a better term, their stance when it comes to what Israel has been doing in Gaza, to see the clear separation where they have really put themselves in a different place than the U.S. has over the past few months, and clearly here now with the ICC arrest warrants, has been a positive step in the right direction.
Thousands of displaced residents of southern Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation after a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah came into effect earlier today. In the hours before the cessation of hostilities, Israel repeatedly struck areas of Beirut and southern Lebanon. Under the deal, Israel will withdraw troops from Lebanon south over a 60-day period, while Hezbollah will move its fighters and weapons to north of the Litani River. Lebanese troops will redeploy to the south. In a joint statement, the U.S. and France said, quote, this announcement will create the conditions to restore lasting calm and allow residents in both countries to return safely to their homes, unquote. Lebanon's caretaker prime minister, Najib Mikati, spoke earlier today.
Truly, it is a new day, concluding one of the most difficult stages of suffering that the Lebanese have experienced in their modern history. It actually was the most harsh as well as hopeful. On this day, the 1,000-mile journey begins to rebuild what was destroyed and to complete strengthening the role of legitimate institutions, at the forefront of which is the army, on which we place great hopes to extend the state's authority over the whole nation and strengthen its presence in the wounded south.
Over the past 14 months, Israel's killed over 3,800 people in Lebanon and displaced more than a million. Israel also killed the entire leadership of Hezbollah, including Hassan Nasrallah and two of his successors. Hezbollah rocket attacks on northern Israel forced tens of thousands of Israelis to flee their homes. We're joined now by two guests. In Tel Aviv, in Israel, we're joined by Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, where he's a member of its editorial board. His latest book, The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe. And in Montreal, Canada, Lina Munzer is with us, Lebanese writer, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. You know, I remember just after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, Lina, you were in our studio here, and you wrote about what it was like to see an attack on your country from afar, what it meant. Talk about the significance of the ceasefire now.
I mean, of course, you know, it's a welcome relief for the entire country to have the ceasefire. At the same time, it leaves so much devastation behind, you know, and you spoke about in the last hours, the Israelis continued bombing up until, I'm not sure that that conveys the level of barbarism. I mean, they were essentially carpet bombing, you know, the south and Beirut and hitting all kinds of targets and, you know, it absolutely indiscriminately. You know, Israelis always talk about targeted attacks and people buy this, and it's reported even that, you know, when innocent civilians die, it's usually as a collateral damage to these targeted attacks. And of course, there have been targeted assassinations. We've seen them already. The idea that, you know, that civilians are acceptable collateral damage to this kind of targeted assassination is already just a completely outrageous idea. But, you know, yesterday in the final hours of the ceasefire, I had a dear friend who lost his elderly parents. There was absolutely no warning, and they were targeted directly in their apartment. And based on essentially, I suppose, erroneous AI information. And this is something that has happened to countless families over the course of these last 14 months. It was especially difficult. You know, I am in Montreal, but I was speaking to friends throughout the day. I was hearing the airstrikes. People were terrified. People were running on foot. There was absolutely no safe place to hide. It was truly like, you know, at 24 hours that were just condensed horror. And it is absolute terrorism. It is barbarism. I don't have any other words to describe it. And so there's a lot of relief now as we go into the ceasefire. At the same time, there's a lot of apprehension because we're not sure how long it's going to last. It feels like a very fragile truce, essentially. And also, you know, people are coming back not just to devastated homes and devastated lands in the south, but they're picking up the pieces of their lost, you know, families. There are a lot of people now who are going to be able to have funerals that they weren't able to have, memorials that they weren't able to have. You know, the grieving process begins now, not just for the country at large, but specifically for so many families who have lost their loved ones, including up until these final 24 hours. So yes, there is relief, but there's also a lot of apprehension and just an incredible amount of grief, you know. People are finding it very difficult to celebrate. A lot of people that I spoke to just said, I have no energy to do anything today but just sit and cry, you know. So it is, again, very, very mixed feelings around this. But of course, a lot of relief, just at least that the killing is over, because it was just barbaric.
And Lina, what do we know about the terms of this ceasefire or truce? And we've heard from Netanyahu and Biden, but Hezbollah has been silent until now. What do we know about of their perspective?
I think Hezbollah spoke about it earlier. They did not release statements after the U.S. and Israel released their statements. They had spoken earlier just in agreeing essentially to this truce already. So I think that was the statement that they gave, you know, that spoke on their behalf essentially. What we know about, you know, I've heard so many different things about the terms of this truce, and I've read many different things. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure because there's so many contradictory things. But from what I read, Yes, there is this idea that the Israelis are now going to withdraw over 60 days their troops. I mean, already they've been, people are going, flocking to the south to just see the destruction. And the Israelis have been threatening, you know, since yesterday that it's not safe to return to the south. You're not allowed to return until we tell you to return. So already, you know, this idea that there's going to be a restoration of some kind of, you know, Lebanese sovereignty over the land, this is already being contradicted by the behavior and the directives of the Israeli army. And, you know, essentially also what I've read and what I've seen is that Israel has the right to violate Lebanese sovereignty at any moment, so should they decide that there is excuse enough. And, you know, when Israel acts with the impunity that we've seen it act with, and we know that it has the absolute full backing of the United States, it's also very difficult to feel safe as a Lebanese person, or to feel that this, the terms of this truce are in any way safe, you know, or in any way provide some sense of security, because you know that at any point they can use any excuse that they like, and it will be accepted. You know, it will be accepted. There's nothing that we can say on the world stage that is going to prevent violation, further violation, further carpet bombing. So there really is a sense of being completely exposed, you know, before the world, and having no political recourse, essentially being at the mercy of these larger powers, which, you know, they have demonstrated again and again their brutality over the last 14 months, not just in Lebanon, but much more largely in Gaza.
I want to bring Gideon Levy into this conversation in Tel Aviv. Gideon, if you could start off by responding to, there was a latest text from the Israeli negotiator Gershon Baskin, who wrote, "The ceasefire agreement, which went into effect today, is good news. The agreement is between Israel and the government of Lebanon, not between Israel and Hezbollah. It seems that Hezbollah has been weakened enough to end the war in Lebanon before the war in Gaza has ended." Your response to this, and also the response in Israel right now to, I think it was about 4 a.m. that the ceasefire or the cessation hostilities went into effect.
Yes, I wish I could tell you that Israel is happy about the ceasefire. I wish I could tell you that there is even a relief in Israel. But unfortunately, in Israel, almost everyone is critical about this agreement. I guess many Israelis did not have enough. For sure, the right wingers, for sure, the most of the inhabitants of the north, they would like to see more blood and more destruction in Lebanon. And therefore, they are so sour today. And the other camp, as usual, is saying nothing. And even one of the opposition leaders, Benny Gantz, even criticized the ceasefire. He thought the war should go on. In other words, Israel wants wars. Nobody should have any illusions. Netanyahu has no intention to put an end to the war in Gaza. What happened in Lebanon will not happen soon in Gaza, because if he goes for an agreement in Gaza, he loses his government, and that's his top priority. And Israel, at least part of Israel, has very serious intentions to resettle Gaza. Don't underestimate those settlers. The sky's the limit for them. They just wait for Donald Trump to get into the office. And I will not be surprised if we'll very soon later see settlements in Gaza. In other words, nothing was solved yesterday except of the punishment of Lebanon, which came to its end. But also, this is for a very limited time. I mean, when the prime minister speaks about the agreement, and all he has to say are threats about Lebanon and Hezbollah, that if any violation will take place, immediately Israel will attack again. So we are going from one war to the other, and from one violent confrontation to the other, without even suggesting any other alternative. Nothing. Nobody speaks about diplomacy. Nobody speaks about touching the core issues, both in the north and in the south. Our friend from Lebanon, our Lebanese friend, just mentioned violations of the sovereignty of Lebanon. Anyone speaks about the fact that Israel, I'm sure, will continue to fly over Lebanon for intelligence. This will be kosher. This will be legitimate. And only the violation of Israeli sovereignty is never forgiven.
And Gideon Levy, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the toll on the IDF now, over 800 soldiers have been killed in Gaza. About the estimates are about 73 or 74 in Lebanon, and those are the only ones publicly acknowledged. What is the impact on Israel of continuing this war on the economy of Israel, on migration, on tourism, and the other aspects of economic life in Israel?
The price is enormous, but somehow Israeli accepted. This is this unbelievable phenomena in which people are ready to sacrifice the dearest ones. I mean, who is more than your son? Without seeing a real purpose. I mean, they all tell themselves that they were killed, sacrificed for the defense of Israel. What kind of defense is it? What does Israel benefit out of it? The economical price is one thing. I mean, you mentioned tourism. There is no tourism whatsoever. There are hardly any international airlines to fly in here. But there is a much heavier price. It's not only that Netanyahu and the Gallant are now wanted all over the world. Every Israeli will feel it when he will go abroad now. Every Israelis everywhere will feel at least discomfort in presenting himself, identifying himself as an Israeli. And still Israelis are ready to take this only because they were told that we have to live from war, to live on our sword, and there is no other option, which is a total lie because Israel never tried an alternative.
Lena Munzer, on what you expect to happen from here as you watch what has happened to your country, at least for this moment, from afar.
Look, we're very terrified of the day after. Mr. Levy talked about the effect on internal Israeli politics. We're also very afraid. Lebanon is a very fragile, you know, pluralist state. But at the same time, the Israelis also have known very much how to work on that. So they've been specifically bombing where the refugees have gathered. We've seen over the last few months that people have been turning away refugees. These refugees are largely Shia from South Lebanon and from the southern suburbs of Beirut. So there's been a lot of hostility that has incurred. So we're really, really afraid of the day after in terms of, you know, the internal stability of the country and what's going to happen to it. And I just want to say, you know, to go back to this idea of collateral damage, this is something that the United States normalized, you know, in our region, in Iraq, the way to punish an entire country in order to change some sort of internal mechanism, which then devastates the country because, of course, they have no idea what they're doing. And this is not how you bring about change. So we're all also very afraid of now what's going to happen to Lebanon internally as we go on. And as the pieces are picked up and a lot of anger and recrimination is going to start coming to the surface among the population. So, you know, as we say in Arabic, Allah yustur, like we have no idea what's going to happen.
Friday night's anti-NATO protest has received Canada-wide condemnation, with politicians decrying a demonstration that ended in broken windows at Montreal's Convention Centre, where NATO was holding its 70th Parliamentary Assembly. On Monday, Montreal Mayor Valérie Plante thanked the police for intervening against what she called professional vandals.
We've all seen the images. We've all seen the videos of what happened on Friday. People just destroying. They were doing it with a big smile on their face, having no sense of respect for property, or even to take away the sense of the protest itself, because those people, because they are professional CASA, you know, it could have been any other type of protest. They would have been there to do that, to destroy.
But activists like Ibrahim Weisfeld see the police response was disproportionate, as the SPVM dispersed the crowd with batons, shields, and extensive use of chemical irritants. sending at least two protesters to the emergency room.
They wanted to stop us from continuing. You know, they didn't stop, you know, people from smashing the windows of the bank, you know, which is natural. But then afterwards, they come after us, you know, like, why? You know, because they think that we're getting tired? No, we don't get tired. Period.
The protests began around 5:30 on Friday, when almost 500 Montrealers gathered at Place des Arts in opposition to the Western Defense Alliance and their lack of sanctions or embargo against Israel.
We stand here against the weapons, against militarism, against the Western powers, until Palestine is free, until Lebanon is free, until all of us are free!
After speeches concluded, protesters walked south into Chinatown, with a few confrontations between officers and a small group of protesters near the front. Officers deployed pepper spray and, in one case, what appeared to be a rubber bullet, while protesters sprayed paint and set off sparklers and smoke bombs. Around 6:30, a dozen or so protesters smashed windows at the convention center where NATO was held, with everything from the wooden poles of their protest flags to hammers seemed brought specifically for the occasion. Nearby CIBC had already had its window smashed. It was then that the SPVM called on protesters to disperse. The crowd ran as hundreds of riot police began to charge from behind, spraying repeated rounds of tear gas into the air behind and around the protest.
Nous, on était comme à la fin de la manif, puis justement, on n'avait pas conscience de ce qui se passait devant. Puis moi, ça me paraissait encore comme une manif très pacifiste, puis il n'y avait rien de... Puis tu sais, ça chantait, ça jouait de la musique et tout.
This Concordia student, who asked not to be named out of fear for their safety, told CKUT that at the far back of the demonstration, everything had felt normal and peaceful. That is, until they came to the convention center. When the tear gas started, they started running along with the crowd, fearing they might be trampled if they fell.
Puis là, quand on passait dans le tunnel, à un moment donné, j'ai commencé à entendre, à sentir comme, avoir comme des trucs explosés à côté. Puis là, rapidement, je pouvais plus respirer, je pouvais plus ouvrir les yeux. Puis ça, j'ai jamais eu autant peur pour ma sécurité qu'à ce moment-là, parce que tout le monde s'est mis à courir, parce que t'es gazé, tu vois plus rien, tu respires pas, puis tu t'entrevois la police qui se met à courir après. Fait que ça a comme créé un énorme mouvement de foule de gens qui couraient. Moi, j'étais comme, si je tombe, je me fais piétiner. Genre, j'avais super peur. C'était comme tout. Et on était super coincés à cause que c'était dans le tunnel. Fait que c'était complètement démesuré. Beaucoup trop violent de la part de la police pour genre ce qu'on était réellement en train de faire.
Most protesters were able to get away safely, or safely enough after being gassed. But some ended up in the emergency room. Kira Prentice, Noor Kakano, and another protester tried to leave, as Kakano's asthma left them disoriented and in distress.
And so I reported being blinded and suffocating from the tear gas. Because of my disability, I was not able to run. I was very incapacitated. So Kira and the others were like, let's go, let's walk. And they expected me to walk, but I wasn't really, I was not being super responsive and super communicative because I was really, really out of it.
That's when they say a small group of officers started hitting them with batons and shields. Here's Kira Prentice.
My first direct interaction with police that whole night was getting hit in the back of the head by a police officer who I did not see and did not know was there, while attempting to administer first aid to my comrade who was having an asthma attack because of the tear gas police had shot at us. And then they did continue to repeatedly strike us with the baton. I really do mean full windups and full swings.
A spokesperson for the SPVM told CKUT they had no record of that part of the intervention or the injuries sustained by the two protesters. But photographer William Wilson documented some of the incident in a series of photos shared with CKUT.
There was one officer that was just kind of standing there, and he was the most westward one. And he was just standing there with his shield, and he was screaming, like, "Rouge, rouge." But it was the other cop that was to his right, and that was the one that was really wailing at them. I think he hit them with a full, like, 180-degree swing at least I mean, you can see it in my photos, and you can count how many times that he winds up and hits them, but I think he hit them at least between three and five times. And one girl is screaming at him and trying to shield her friend.
It's an experience that's left a mark on the protesters in more ways than one.
I'm in pain. It hurts to sit. It hurts to lie down. It hurts to move. It hurts to do my job. That I'm really afraid they want to let me go because with a broken hand, I work a little bit slower now. Sleeping is hard because it is hard to get comfortable, and I am racked by nightmares and visions of stress.
And for Kakano, who now has a concussion, the experience has been even worse.
You know, I can't work. I can't do anything. I can't really cook for myself because I get a huge migraine. I've just like been sleeping for the past like 72 hours. I don't even sleep properly. I keep having nightmares of what happened. I don't get their intent. If their intention was for us to leave, then why were they beating us when I was like begging them to stop?
The protest ended with three arrests of individuals in their 20s on charges of assaulting officers and obstructing police work. Police also told CKUT the protesters had set fire to two cars during the demonstration. After reports from TVA, the Gazette, and others suggested the fires could have been the outcome of the police intervention, the SPVM apparently told them they're investigating the cause. They have not yet responded to a request for comment from CKUT. It's not the only correction on Friday's protest, which has garnered condemnation from high-profile politicians at all levels of government. On Saturday, Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly and Public Safety Minister Bill Blair called the protest violent and hateful, but also anti-Semitic. Neither office responded to a request for comment on this latter charge. The Prime Minister also insinuated the same, writing on X that, quote, "What we saw on the streets of Montreal last night was appalling. Acts of anti-Semitism, intimidation, and violence must be condemned wherever we see them." It was a message echoed by Montreal Mayor Valérie Plante on Monday.
This weekend, we've seen people and we've seen words being said that were anti-Semitism, like big time. And that is not acceptable. There's people now from the Jewish community that, you know, have been scared for a while. And we can definitely relate when we see people protesting and using those hatred words. This does not have its place here in Montreal. The right to protest is within our society. It is protected, fine, but not to have such hatred speeches or to break things just for the sake of it.
But when asked by CKUT about what part of Friday's protest was anti-Semitic, the mayor said that she was in fact referring to a lone individual who performed a Nazi salute at a different protest last week.
And the protest on Friday, maybe there will be videos and stuff, and maybe there's words that have been said that were anti-Semitic. I don't think so, because the protest itself was to just share concern about what's happening in Palestine.
Friday night's protest was the last and largest of at least four demonstrations held against NATO. But protesters' anti-NATO message has been largely overshadowed by the public backlash against their tactics. At a smaller protest the day before, Benoit Allard of the Divest for Palestine collective told CKUT that as long as NATO members continue arming Israel, the public will keep fighting back.
They say they are talking about security, but what we're asking is the security of whom and at what price. And currently, the vision of NATO of security is defending the interest of the Western powers through military force. This is not building peace, this is building oppression. And for us, what builds peace is resistance to oppression. It's solidarity across borders, across people.
But whether protesters' message was heard is an open question. Here's Juliet Zerowitz, who led Canada's delegation in NATO's Parliamentary Assembly, speaking at a press conference earlier on Friday.
I'm not going to be responding to any questions around Israel and Palestine and what's happening in the Middle East, other than that is very much part of our deliberations and part of our considerations and part of our discussions here.
When reached by CKUT, an SPVM spokesperson refused to comment on the specific tactics used during the police intervention. CKUT will continue to follow this story as it develops. I'm Jules Pujol, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
That's it for today. On today's show, we focused on the ICC's arrest warrants against Israeli top leaders and how Canadian politicians reacted to these warrants. We look into the ceasefire reach in Lebanon and how both Lebanese and Israeli reacted to it. Finally, we saw what happened during the anti-NATO protest that took place in Montreal. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca.